Good evening, everybody. Well, welcome to another awesome episode of Something from Nothing, where a bunch of us game designers get together and we just talk about game design in general and problems we're having and all sorts of other cool, cool stuff. I am Jason Slingerland from the Building the Game podcast. With us, our standard panel, we have Rob Couch, also from the Building the Game podcast. We have Chevy Dodd, designer of Scallywags, and a lot of games he'll tell you are not any fun. And also we have T.C. Petty, who designed Viva Java and Viva Java Dice. And we have a special guest this evening, and that is Jason Tagmeyer. I will let him tell you all about himself. Okay, Jason, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Jason Tagmeyer. I designed a couple games. Pixel Lincoln is probably the one that you may have heard of. It's a deck-building game featuring Abe Lincoln in 16-bit fashion. I also designed a game called Maximum Throwdown that AEG released. It's a card-throwing battle game. And I was co-set designer, actually, on Quarrier's Quest of the Gladiator. And other than that, I have a thing that I make called Storyteller Cards. It's not really a game. It's just like a tool to enable creativity that Chevy backed and has not received yet. I mean TC backed and has not received yet.
So I'm waiting for it.
Yes, this week.
Yeah. And you've got one on Kickstarter right now, right?
Yeah, it's a expansion for Pixel Lincoln, and it's a big left.
Uh-oh, we seem to be having technical difficulties.
That almost never happens.
Never happens here.
Not
never.
On this show.
The internet is a wonderful thing.
When it works. Sometimes. All right. Okay. Well, let's all just sit here and stare at each other. This is lots of fun. So let's.
Best show ever.
We'll start off by just. Is anybody working on anything that they want to talk about that's not published yet? Maybe a design they're working on where you might have some questions or things you need or trying to work out. Jason, if you have something, we'll default to you first because you're a guest and. People probably want to hear you more than us anyway, so, yeah.
Let's see. I'm working on a bunch of things. One of them is it's like a small card game. It fits into maybe about 54 cards. It's called Seven Sevens or Sevens right now. The idea is it's seven different little of seven cards, each one is seven. For example, Seven Deadly Sins, Seven Wonders of the World, Seven Colors of the Rainbow, things like that. The problems I'm having right now, I don't know, it kind of just came together over the past couple days, so there's a billion problems with it. But the one, I guess the biggest one, is it gets really like swingy in the end, and it's not really intentional. What happens is you're trying to get highest amount of points, and your cards are 1 through 7 in those various suits, and each suit gives a special ability. For example, Wonder would allow me to look at someone's hand. Sins would allow me to make somebody discard a card at random. Trying to get
Am I the one frozen, or did we lose him?
I think we lost him.
Yeah, I think we lost him for a second, at least.
Okay. Did we lose Jason, too?
All I'm seeing is Jason's logo.
I'm here. My picture went out, but I'm still here.
Okay.
Oh, the internet.
He's hey, back.
Jason Tagmeyer is doing this video call.
Hey. Is it my internet?
I think so.
Yeah.
We lost you.
Oh. I can relocate to a better spot. So I have seven suits and seven things and lots of stuff happening. And trying to get the best three-card hand. And one of the cards allows... So what happens... You get to the very end of your game and you have, for example, you know, seven, seven, and six. And everybody either knows that or... I don't even know. But what happens is... If you make somebody discard a card during their last turn. They discard their 7 or whatever. Then they draw back and get like a 1, and then the game ends. So just picture this as like the end of the game. What happens is now you get stuck with this 1, and you've built up this whole time working on these 7s and these 6s, and all of a sudden you get stuck with this terrible card, and boom, the game's over, and everybody else is sitting on 7s and 6s and 5s and higher things than you. So the end of the game got really terrible when, you know, somebody makes you discard a card and boom, the game ends. Because you have no control whatsoever at that point. So if that makes sense to anybody, my little fix that I had for it was one of the suits enables you to change the high number that's available. So 7's your highest card you can have in hand, and one of the suits is the 7 Ages of Man, and it just basically ages the cards, and the 7 now becomes a 6. I'm not sorry, the 7 becomes a 0, and 6 becomes the highest card available. So someone who's sitting on all these 7s now can... there's a little fault, and it's a problem because now they're worth nothing. So that's what I did to kind of fix the end game issue of somebody just sitting on all these good cards and then everybody else losing, but I don't know. So that's where I'm kind of at with it. And
so how many cards do we have in hand like throughout the game? Do we
three
do the deck
total.
Out?
It's just three cards always. Total. Yep.
And you have to like play one a turn or something? Or
so you play one on a turn, and you're going to play it on top of a pile.
Okay.
And the pile is... that suit, only that suit. So okay. I play a wonder on the wonder pile. And basically by playing a card, you activate the ability, you get rid of the number, and you don't have that anymore.
Are there things that mess with the piles?
So the piles get messed with by... the age cards can be played on any pile. So I didn't even explain the end of the game. The end of the game is when you have a pile of 7. When a pile hits 7, game ends. So age cards mess with the piles, as in just make them bigger. Other cards allow you to remove from the pile. There's 7 Cs that allows you to take a card from a pile back to your hand. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else that messes with the piles. That might be it.
So when does so everybody knows exactly when the game ends then?
So it will end when any pile hits 7.
Right.
So it could happen at any time. And
when you say best 3 card hand, you're saying like best poker hand? So 3 1s.
No, best
7s.
3 highest number.
Oh.
So
oh.
21 being the highest hand.
Oh. Okay.
So the problem that I was having was, you know, I've got 20 and someone makes me discard a card and I draw back to a 1 and then they end the game on their next turn. So right. You know, it was just then I have 7, 7, and 1, and it's just over. So
you have, so is it 49 cards then?
It is 49, yeah.
Okay, so you have a little bit of leeway then. Is there a way to give someone, that's the little, that doesn't make 7 anymore. It goes a little over. But anyway, is there a way, somehow, to give someone a secret objective based on one of those ages, one of those 7 things? Maybe even if the cards are double-sided, like you can pick one of the two.
Okay.
Maybe that way there's a secret thing that only they know about, and so even if they know the game's coming to a close and they get one of those ones, it's not as bad just because maybe their side goal is not maybe to get 21 points. Maybe they're trying to get the lowest, or maybe other people are trying to do something in the middle. I don't know.
That's really cool. Yeah. Definitely, like, if one of the 8, one of the 7s was certain objectives, would be really neat.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out if you could have, like, a pseudo fourth card, you know, like a reserve or something that you could draw from.
So one of the cards I did was Lucky God. It kind of made it basically different, and it was you play the Lucky God down, and if the color or number of the card matched the next card that's flipped over on the deck, you get to put that into like this tableau reserve area that is just points at the end of the game, bonus points at the game. So it was really, really great if it worked. And if it didn't work, there's almost no downfall. The only downfall is you flip the top card and everybody could see it, so now they know a card that's in your hand. So being this super lucky, awesome thing. It just, it sort of down, you know, for it to be worth it, you know, to not be just a flat out positive.
So is the discard card the only card that's really messing with the end game? Or are there other powers that are doing that too?
The discard, let me see. So here's one that does colors, seven colors of the rainbow. Basically, each card has a color and a number on it, and the color becomes wild for the round. So whatever card is at the top of the color pile is the wild color that you could use as any suit. And then at the end of the game, the color is worth 7 points. That kind of messes with it a little bit as well.
Well, I think as long as you obscure the end game a little bit so that you can't 100%, it'll feel a little bit more, I don't know. It feels, by adding less control, it feels a little bit more in control. Like, if you've been holding on for, if the game's too long, and you've been holding on, and then all of a sudden someone goes, last turn, ha ha ha, then it sucks. But, like, if you don't know exactly, and the game ends before you can really get all sevens, then I think it doesn't have as much of an issue, I guess.
And I think doing the one thing that I did with the age definitely changes the sevens to zeros. Really, there was this struggle for that. Basically, the whole game, you know, I'm putting that age out, you know, bringing zero, and somebody else is playing the C card to take that age back to hand to make sevens available again. So that did help quite a bit, so...
That's cool.
Like I said, it's still just very infancy as of yesterday. That's where it kind of started. It was a pitch tag thing from like a week ago.
That's
my big mess.
Yeah, that seems like just knowing that you only have the three cards, it's that's hard to mess with. It doesn't give you a whole lot of leeway to mess with things.
A
little bit.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like
when you have a bunch of something, then you can do little tweaks and things like discard a card. But when discarding a card is a third of your points, that's really strong.
It's harsh.
Yeah, well,
and right
I mean,
now
what
this card is a random, so you know I hold up my three and then you choose one, which is even harsher.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I was trying to think like, what if you tweak the discard mechanic a little bit? So it's like, I discard, you know, a color, and so what I get back is the top card of the color stack. I don't draw from randomly from you know, the deck or whatever. So at least. There's a slight, I don't know.
Yeah. No, definitely gonna try that.
It seems harsh.
That's the problem with these little games, like the micro games. Like they put a lot of restrictions on you. I don't know if, but that's the thing. Having not played it, it's hard to know if that three card restriction is too much or, in some cases, maybe even too little. You know.
Yeah, definitely. With three cards, it's just, you know, the whole time you're kind of sitting on two, and then one is kind of going in and out the whole time until you get something better, which sometimes doesn't happen if you're sitting on sevens. So I'm gonna mess around and try it with different amounts because I haven't even changed that at all. That's basically just because it's a small deck and trying to make it last the entire game. The three-card hand was helping with that.
Yeah, and it might be something where like you need to adjust the point range of different suits. You know, more powerful suits have lower cards or something like that. So if you're going to hold them, you're going to have a smaller hand.
Definitely.
So on a side note, Jason, do you still have the awesome like area that you do design in?
That's where I'm at right now.
Oh, that's where you're at. Oh, okay. You're still renting out the little space?
So it's actually a different space. I was renting out a space like next to my house that was really, really nice, but I had to pay for it, and then I found a space that's like 2 miles from my house that's free. So I moved there, and it's basically the same size, and I can come in. The other one was limited. They closed at 9 p.m. on the weeknights and closed at 4 on weekends. And I was just like, that's when I would be there.
Yeah.
This, I can kind of come here at any time and stay here all night if I need to.
So how has it been as far as, because I know a lot of designers out there probably thinking about doing something like this, but getting a specific space to stay in, is that does that make it a lot easier to come up with creative things, or is it, do you find yourself sitting there doing nothing for a long time?
Most of the time it's a very positive thing. For me, it's, my house is super loud with the kids, and they're just screaming at all hours of the day. I can call them right now and you'll hear screaming. They just fight all day long, so if I come here, I can focus. If I'm there, I can't. It's just impossible. So I'll come here, and I'll get a lot of work done, and I'll usually kind of restrict myself from doing non-work. I'll put on something on Hulu or Netflix or something, kind of just to pass the time, but I'll like refuse to go on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. Because that'll just eat up all the time. And lately, it hasn't been a ton of design work. It's been mostly just getting Kickstarter rewards together and, you know, more of, I guess, that publisher side of things or fulfillment side of things, which is terrible, and I wouldn't suggest it to anybody. But, yeah, when I do come here for design stuff and I meet other people up here, it's really cool, and I would suggest it to anybody, especially if you have kids.
Do you have any tips on finding free spaces? I mean, that's the magic secret right there.
Family? My father-in-law has an auction house, and the basement's loaded with all kinds of crazy memorabilia, and there's this little green room off to the side that I took.
Nice.
So, yeah, that's family. Awesome. I don't have any other...
Chevy, based on where you live, you could consider a treehouse somewhere out in the woods. That might be true.
There is a creepy, like, abandoned house just over the wood line for my development that I could go in.
Dude, done. You got it. It's, you know where you're going to go design now.
I do. I'm doing a lot of zombie games, so I mean, I know. Need a place, right? We'll see. Well, speaking of tech, Jason, what happened to the zombie game? Where's that at? We haven't heard much from you lately.
So, was it last week you guys were talking about print and play and results of that? So I put it up for sale and then put it up for print and play kind of at the same time and got no response to either. So it kind of just it kind of sat for a little while, and then I had some people that were interested, the guys from Island Officials that I do Pixel Lincoln with, but I kind of have to run things for them, and I don't know that I want to run something that's, because I'd have to do it on Kickstarter for them, and because I do that on their behalf, and I don't really want to do a big game. It's not even that big of a game, but a game that has all these different components. We did a game, Pigpen, that's basically just cards. So I think that's of the level that I want to run for them right now. It's just a game that's just cards, because it's so much easier to get through the, you know, the production system then figure out all the rest. So it got backburnered for those reasons, but it also got backburnered because it's a zombie game that's very flat, and it doesn't have that appeal that the normal zombie games have of being, you know, 3D and awesome looking. It's very flat, almost looks like a zombie checker style game.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, Chevy, you've been working on Deadwoods, right, for Naga Demon?
Yeah, I did. I guess I finished it almost in time. We play tested it, I don't know, probably two or three times, but it's one of those games that, like, I probably didn't even really need to test. Like, there's really nothing going on in the game, so... And it's random enough that it can be compelling, so, yeah. But, I found an art, like a Twitter follower volunteered to do the artwork, and he's
cool.
Done. Yeah, the sketches that he sent. He finished up some inking yesterday and tweeted a picture, and I tweeted it out. It was like, holy crap, this is amazing. So, you know, it's probably going to be one of my better looking games, even though I don't really have any plans. You know, it's a two player goofy zombie game. Like, there's no market for that. So I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to release it as print and play and put it on some print-on-demand sites and sell it to six people and be happy. You know, it was really for me. It was for me and Jamie anyway, so it's like I'm just, you know, as long as I actually have a physical copy when all's said and done, I'll be happy.
Yeah.
I don't know, we were talking about print and play and Game Crafter and all those other print and demand things. I think that is kind of the goal when you go with those. I mean, other than maybe getting picked up later by a bigger publisher, but you're not going to get the same feedback from a print and play or the others that you would get from another game, even though it's fun.
Yeah, sure. You know, like Tuesday Night Tanks, I put this game out, and there is no print and play because it's kind of ridiculous to try and print and play a 3D tanks and whatever. But, it's $25. It's really like a $15 game, but I sell it for $25, and I've sold like 30-some copies of that game through the Game Crafter. Wow. Just kind of, I don't know why. I have no clue. Like, I've never marketed it. I've not done nothing with this game except put it on the Game Crafter. And it's, you know, tank. What? Those 30 sales... Every time I get that email that says you just sold a copy and I see somebody tweet about it or whatever, those 30 sales are way better than the 10 or 12,000 sales that Scallywags has had so far. You know, it's just like, those 30 sales mean way more to me than anything else. So I'm going to keep doing it. My trick-taking game will probably go on there also because I don't, there's no market for trick-taking games. So I'm not even going to try and publish that with a publisher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just got my first one up on GameCrafter a couple of weeks ago. The Rumplebum Academy that I've been working on for a couple of months now. That's my first one to ever have available for sale somewhere, and it's kind of exciting. You're right. I mean, same deal with this. The theme has no interest to anybody, so I don't expect to sell any copies. But
what is the theme?
It's the players are trolls, and as everybody knows, trolls love to bake. You know, so you're students at the Rumplebum Academy for bug-based baking, and you have to go out into the woods and you have to collect bugs. You have to, all the cards have rocks on the back, and you turn them over and you get bugs, and you have to collect different kinds of bugs to get different recipes. And every now and then, you'll get a princess, and princesses are kind of wild cards. And every now and then, a knight will show up and attack you, and then you have to throw rocks at him to kill him. It's kind of silly. It's a silly kind of fun memory game targeted towards a young audience. But that theme is so ridiculous that I don't expect anybody to buy it. I think I've sold 3 copies so far to friends. And that's it, because my friends are nice.
I don't think it's the worst theme that I've seen, and the most unviable theme.
Yeah, it's,
I think at a glance, just princesses and, you know, trolls is right up there.
Yeah. it's dumb. It's really dumb. But I had a lot of fun putting it together. It was a fun project just to do the artwork, you know, because I was looking for an excuse to take something all the way through to completion. You know, everything we've done for the podcast so far has been kind of prototyping and trying to get something ready to show to a publisher, and I hadn't finished anything yet, so that was kind of one of the main goals for this, was for me to actually get something done for a change. And that's very satisfying.
Yes, it is.
It is.
So, yeah. It's available in the Game Crafter if anybody out there is watching and wants to get a copy.
Bob's always about trying to sell it. It's all he talks about on the podcast now. Buy my game!
Sorry, $12.
In about a month, that's all I'm going to be talking about, is trying to get people to buy the extra copies I have of Water Balloon Washouts.
So. Right. Yeah. So, $10.99, you can get your own copy. That's enough.
Nice.
So, we should keep talking here. What is everyone else working on right now?
If I have a thing I'm working on that I could use a little feedback on, a little help with a problem I'm having. But if somebody else has something that they want to talk about, by all means, we can do that instead.
Go for it, man.
Yeah, do it.
All right, so earlier I was talking about... I was holding cards up. I'm going to hold my card up. I was talking about the cards from my Gunsling and Ramblers game. I talked about it on the podcast. I recently got that back from the publisher, and I've been working on some different things for it, trying to balance some things out. And so in the game, there's a simplified poker mechanic. and you get three cards dealt to you, but each card has an entire poker hand on it. Actually, each card has two entire poker hands, but you're going to choose one of those hands to play, and things will resolve like normal poker. The issue I'm running into is I really want there to be a solid betting mechanic like poker has, but I don't know if any of you guys are... I know some of you guys are familiar with poker. You get a lot of issues with side pots, which would happen if, just for anybody out there that doesn't know, like if you and I are both betting, and you bet everything you have, and then I bet more than that, and there's a third person still playing, and they match my bet, now we have $100 in more than you do, that $100 is put off to the side because you can't win it because you had not enough money. The problem, so in poker that works great. In a board game, it's a big pain in the butt, and I don't want to do that. And one of the people I had talked to had given me feedback that I should just completely take out the betting mechanic and just make it be a set amount that goes in every hand. If you want to play the hand, you have to buy in for that much. And that would keep going up throughout the game. And I don't know how I feel about that. Part of me says it's super simple and practical, and it makes it so that you don't have to worry about betting. It just gets rid of it. But being that I designed this and I like poker, and I want you to feel like you can play it without knowing poker, because everything in the game is made to simplify it, so if you've never played poker, you'll still be able to play the game and have a great time. But if you've played poker, I also don't want you to feel like, well, this is just kind of on autopilot, you know? So somebody give me an awesome idea of how to fix that.
Can you play with limits instead of no limit?
You can, but there's still always going to be the chance that I'm out of money, even though I've started betting, right? So I put money into the pot. I've started betting.
Sure.
Now I've run out. You know, another suggestion that somebody had given me was, what if, and this is probably the best suggestion, what if there's a specific buy-in for each hand, and that could be escalating? Or maybe it's not, but there's a specific buy-in, and that is the limit for the hand. So you can't ever bet more than what you've got for the hand. And at the beginning, we all put $100 in, knowing that that's what we're going to bet with. But his argument was, if we're going to do that, why are they even betting? You know, because everybody's just going to go all in anyways, so why not just force them to do that?
What happens in the game if someone runs out of money?
If they run out of money, they're out. You have these different ramblers. That was the card I showed you, which was basically cowboys. And in the game, you get a set number of cowboys. And when you run out of money, you would have to get a new one who would bring you more money. Does that make sense? So, like, every time a new guy sat down at the table, you could give him so much money. But, you know, so running out is bad because you continuously are losing your people by running out, and you only have a set number of people in your posse who can come to this card table. Another note, they're also shooting and killing each other after the because people are cheating. So you're losing them in multiple ways.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that if that the best hand wins, period, no matter what, doesn't matter how much you put into the pot, the best hand wins. But if you ended up betting less, if you were in that situation, then you're forced into a gunfight after the hand because everybody else at the table gets mad at you.
You're forced into... No, you mean when you say forced into... Because the way in the game there... And Rob knows this because he knows the game. You can call people out if you think they're cheating. So you're saying if somebody puts money in and it's not enough... So say I put in $100, everybody else bets $500, but I'm out of money, and then I win, everyone else is allowed to shoot me if they want to, right? To tell me they want a gunfight.
Yeah, right. So the way everybody knows that going into it... And you know that if before you even bet, if you have your hand, you have a good hand. If you see one guy who has not much money left and you've got a really bad hand, maybe you don't want to bet at all this round. I don't know. It's just one easy solution, I guess.
So the key to poker, I guess, is the money. Like, and that's the big problem. Like, money makes it all worth it, because if you have a certain amount of money, if you're playing a game, even if you're playing a game and it's just like fake money, it doesn't work as well because it's just like betting, but there's no
no stakes.
Yeah, right. There's no stakes.
It's like if you play poker online, right? Everybody, if it's free money, everybody just bets everything because there's nothing to lose, right?
Sure. Yeah. And I think that if you have that after the hand stuff, what's wrong with just letting that run the game and going with just the buy-in bet and that's it? I mean, you're already abstractifying the poker to, you know, you have a hand on your card and that's what you play. You're not actually playing poker. You're just using this as a mechanism to move money around the table. So just, what's wrong with having a standard buy-in? That's it. And then after the hand resolves, let the after action run the game.
Okay.
That's a good thought. Yeah.
So, okay, so you guys don't find it offensive to just take the betting out?
No, because if you're not, I mean, the way you described it, you're not really playing poker anyway. You're just playing a card that has a hand on it. So, you know.
Okay. If you do that, seems... then you can cut all those poker chip components too, and that shrinks the game size and component size.
Right.
And it's going to speed the game up also because you're not going to have all this downtime of betting and raising and calling and.
In that, I guess another good point of that is if I'm a player who does not like poker, that minimizes the poker aspect even more.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I just had an idea. if you do want to keep it in, and you do want to have like a betting thing, but you only have three cards, and that's kind of cool. So if you play by bluffing, actively bluffing, so if each player has you have your three card hand, right? And I don't know how the whole cheating thing works and how that all works, but if some way you can reveal one of your cards from your hand and bet if you want to stay in the hand. You reveal one card and you bet. Then it goes to the next person. If they're like, oh crap, he already has that, I don't even want to be in this hand, they can fold. If it goes to the next person, they're like, I'm gonna reveal one card and bet. So then it comes back to you, you reveal a second card, and you bet, saying that I'm going to stay in this hand, I still think I have a better hand. So the idea is bluffing that you are going to have the best hand by the time you lay down all three of your cards. And if you do, then you've put all your money in and you showdown. But like someone could call your bet. So what if you in a poker hand, let's just say you had a ace, and then you had a king, and they're both the same suit, and you played those first. The other person's like, oh, crap, he could have, like, a straight flush, he could have a flush, he could have all this. But in essence, you pretty much have a two, so you don't even have a pair. But you're just acting like you do so that they fold before it gets to the end. I think that might add some of that bluffing element to it. And if you can still cheat somehow by, like, sliding cards in or whatever, I don't know, maybe that would help.
That could work. I mean, the way the game is set up right now, each card is a full poker hand. So, like, there are five cards in every card. Well, actually, there are 10 cards in every card. There's a poker hand at the top, and then there's a poker hand at the bottom. One side would say cheat, and one side would say clean. And you, when you put the card out, when you play the card, people can only see one of those cards, and they can't tell whether or not you're cheating or not. Does that make sense? So when everybody reveals their cards, but the way you're saying it, it could actually work. It's totally not how I would have envisioned it, but that's one of the cool things about having somebody that doesn't know about the game give you feedback on what you could do, you know what I mean? Because you're not encumbered by, like, the rules of the game, you know what I mean? You're able to just be like, what if you could do this? And that could be kind of cool as well. If you were trying to build the hand as you played it, you could still do the same thing where one side... You know, the top half has one or two cards. The bottom half has one or two different cards. So you're going to likely have better cards as you go along. So yeah, that's something to think about. Definitely. Thank you.
I was kind of thinking of. Okay. Go ahead. Oh, no, I was thinking of like almost like a voucher or something that everybody gets when you bet. If you don't have a full bet, you get something that just says half, or you get something that says none. Somehow, and then once it's time to distribute the money, it's based off of the vouchers that you have in front of you. It's another component. I don't know, just an idea.
Interesting.
So instead of having the side pot and all, you just have a couple cards, one per player or something, that just say full bet or half bet or no bet.
Right. You know, in the game, at the end of the game, it's a point system to determine who the winner is. It's based on the number of people you shot, so that, like, the bounties that you collected of the people who you killed, because they're all outlaws playing poker. So anybody you shoot, you get a bounty for, because everybody's wanted. And then there's the money, and then there's some other factors. But, you know, that could actually be interesting even as an endgame thing. If you were, every time that happened, when you came up short, you were given a token that you could take all the money, but at the end of the game, you're going to get negative because you chose to pursue that. That could work really well. I like that. Sweet.
I want to shout out real quick here. For any of our listeners, just remember, if you want to ask us any questions, you can tweet at us using hashtag BTGSFN. We're watching that here as we talk, and we'll respond to any questions you guys might have.
That's right.
Nice. Cool. Well, that was awesome feedback, guys. I don't want to hog all the time, so if anybody's got some other game they want to talk about, that'd be cool. I can just keep showing pictures if you want.
Ooh, showing art. Hey, I had a question. Because I'm working on something too. So, I don't know. People have followed me on Twitter, maybe, but I posted like a picture of just something that I was working on earlier. I've got like pieces in front of me, but I don't usually. I've stopped myself usually from like making a game like super fun before I make sure the game's good. So on Twitter, I had this thingy posted.
I saw that.
You can see myself.
Yeah.
Which was just like some sort of like paper animal art kind of thing that I did on Illustrator, right? So I was working on a game about like a quick 10-minute game about survival and everything. So I started making all this like paper animal art. So you can see it here.
Hey, TC, what does the fox say?
I don't know. It's a mystery.
I think my kids could tell you.
But yeah. So, but I started working on this art, and I realized that I'm already going too far.
Never.
Because there's no game. So, what I wanted to know was, you guys usually, it seems like you guys start a lot earlier than I generally do with the art. Is that helpful for playtesting, or is it not, to have something that looks good? I want to get people to play. The problem I have with it, I guess, is that it's a game that plays up to 9 players. And it's really hard to get 9 players to play, especially if like I just had like prototype cards that didn't look like kind of nice. I mean, like I have like something that like looks like that, which everything's mirrored, so it's hard to hold things up. But working in like a papercraft fiasco style. But I really like how it looks. Now I have to see how it plays. Is that going to be something that's going to help me, or do you think it's going to hurt me if like it looks good and then people are like, I don't know if there's a game here?
My standard feedback for this question is, you got to have art, and I don't care if it's like you did with large numbers on a card, or if it's just stolen clip art from a Google search or a clip art library or whatever. You have to have something visual on the card, because as gamers, we don't read every single card every time. We recognize a card from its, you know, it's visually distinct from the rest. I can look across the table and see that you have whatever card because I know what it looks like, and I don't need to pick it up and read it every time you play it. And if you don't have those elements and you just have typeface on a white piece of paper and we're trying to play, it's a very big distraction for playtesters, and it can really break the game because they can't see what's going on the table. We, you know, as creatures, we visually, you know, parse everything that we see. So you got to have something. As far as, you know, numbers on a card, I think that's perfectly fine because it's obvious what it is. If you have a game that requires people to, you know, so my zombie game, for instance, that I've got right now, I've got zombie cards and human cards, and they're both played completely different ways. And so I have to have some sort of visual cue on the card for the person who's going to play the card to remember don't play this face up, play this face down. Don't, you know, this one plays straight to the discard pile. Because otherwise, if they have to remember that or they have to read something, it can break the playtesting session and they will not have fun. But it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't have to be, you know, thematic art even. It just has to be something. I don't care if it's pictures of plungers and crayons in different colors. As long as it's anything, as long as it's something you can look at and know what's going on, then that's all you need. But I always do the art before I design the game, so whatever. It's usually uploaded to the Game Crafter, and then I write the rules and publish. So, you know, that's how I do things.
I'm kind of like,
which makes sense.
I'm like halfway to where he is. Like, I don't think I'll play it with people until it has some decent, and not even, you know, final art or anything, just something like super cool to suck them in. And I'll usually just, before it gets to that point, only play with just other designers that I'm really close to, just right, for the feedback to get me to that point. But once I have it out in the open with other people, I want it to look as good as possible just to get the most natural experience out of them.
One thing I found, just as a tip, because, first of all, I want to validate that Rob and I had trouble. Rob had a game called Splitters that we tried for a while, and it was really wordy, and it didn't have artwork on it. And it was, Chevy's right, it was really difficult. Rob, I'm sure you remember.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to remember what the, you know, like, wait, what card is this? Let me read this paragraph of text on it. But something I did for all you art challenged people out there like myself, I do a lot of cards on white paper. I just give them very catchy names, like every card has a name with a big bold lettering with the text below it, and that tends to get people's attention as well. So, because I don't usually have art for the first several iterations, even when I'm playtesting with more than just my close friends, because I'm terrible at art, and I hate Google cliparting stuff, because, yeah, I just do. So,
yeah, so that was all. For me, doing artwork, and we've struggled. Jason and I have struggled with this this subject since we started getting into this stuff year and a half ago. It's always been a big question for us, and I eventually just decided that making some artwork for a game is part of the fun for me, and so I kind of can't help but not do that. I kind of have to, otherwise I'm not enjoying the process.
Yeah, okay. It keeps me interested in the game. And my other suggestion, going back to the idea box, is use colors. Use a lot of different colors. So like Jason said, with, you know, big bold names, I'll do big bold names on my handwritten copies, but I'll also do them in different colors. So it's, you know, you have another way to visually parse the information. So you can look at the table and see all the green cards are doing this, so I know what they're doing, and, you know, whatever. So,
and you can achieve that. You can achieve that really easy too with card sleeves.
Yeah.
I don't have it in here, but I have a box of card sleeves. Ah, I do. Look at this.
Two different colors.
Show and tell. Multiple colors. There's probably, I used to play miniatures games a lot that had cards, so I literally have thousands of these with different colors, and wow, that makes it super easy to just print something in Word and cut it out and then use the different color backs, you know, to slide them into the sleeves.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to carry all those markers around, but I don't have my bag here, but like Chevy does, I have a bag with a bunch of different color markers in it because Chevy told me to do that, and I do everything Chevy says.
He's
a smart guy.
Yeah. I recommend that.
We have a Twitter comment here from Flash Forward Games on the subject of art. He says, it helps for me because I will feel better showing it off, plus it attracts outside attention, but for functionality, it is a time well. So, yeah, I mean, you got to be willing to put the time into it.
That's a really good analysis too, as far as like the time sink it takes for these things. When I started working on the little art things, I had just woken up and I was like, I had this idea for what the art would look like, but I had no theme or game to attach to it, so I kind of like applied it afterwards. But the problem was, basically, this game was, my friend had pretty much tried to convince me, because it's based on a Montgolfiere mechanic. I'll explain it real quick, but my friend tried to convince me to theme it like a winter-based survival, like almost like a plane crash game, where you're like trying to survive the elements and get to the next thing, and, you know, it's like person who And it's based on points, so it was kind of like the person who had survived but then also thrived the most would, like, take the most away from the experience, I guess. But then I found out that Plaid Hat Games was doing Dead of Winter, and I was like, that sounds exactly the same. So I was like, no, I got to switch real fast. So I ended up, after doing the art, going, I can make this into a cute animal game, so don't get eated. The idea of survival as a group of different animals that are, like, trying to escape, like, either a farm or something like that. But, like, the idea of survival as an animal came up. So I guess you guys were talking about that, the colors. I'm very minimalist, so my color scheme was red. So when the card's red, you see that it's red. Otherwise, it's blank, yep. And then otherwise it's got text on it. So I was like, at least that way, when it's out on the table, you know for a fact what's going on. Sure. But the explain the game real quick and what I'm having an issue with. Like, basically, you have everybody has a deck of cards that's 0 to 11. The 0 card guarantees that you'll survive the round, but you get no points as long as anyone else survives. But other than that, it's all number-based. A threat will come out, and you flip it over, and the threat is a number. And if you play a card from your hand, and it's higher than that number or equal to it, then you survive it. Whoever plays the highest card gets the points for surviving it and thriving. But the key is, if anyone's played Montgolfier, which is an old, late game, I don't know, it's about balloon racing. But it had a really cool mechanic in it called squadroning. So if you play the same number as someone else, either intentionally or unintentionally, you now are on a team, and for every player that's involved in that played the same number, you get 1 point extra added to that number. So if the threat was like a 4, I was like, hey, let's just play this number. You know, let's play a 2. And the idea is that you don't show what's in your hand ever. You just have a card in front of you that has numbers on it. So, and you point, like, hey, yeah, let's play a 2. As long as we both play the 2, we're good. We'll survive the 4, right? And we'll save. But, if the other person screws you over, or if other people at the table don't decide to do that 2, then you can die. So the game is supposed to last about 10 minutes. It lasts about 10 rounds, and you can take 2, like, wounds. Like, if you flip over your card and you're wounded, and then you're out of the game if you don't survive again. As far as problems I'm having is that just getting that out in front of people and playtesting it, it's really tough to get that going, especially since it's number-based. I'm worried also that I'm going to get a lot of feedback based on the art as opposed to the game. So I'm trying to figure out where the math is, but I'm just worried about putting it in front of people because of that. The end game is going to be really hard also. So two things, how do you get over that initial part with getting people, but then also how difficult can a game be with cute animals dying? That's the theme.
I kind of had the opposite thing with, like, I always want to have the art looking really good by the time I play test, but then sometimes I'm worried that it's going to, you've got the opposite, you're worried that, they're going to look at the art, but mine's that they might kind of forget the game and kind of fall into the art. So the gameplay doesn't live up to the art, as opposed to the opposite where you're saying the art doesn't live up to the gameplay. I get worried about that people
I think it's a balance.
That they might just think that the art looks so good, not that I've ever had art that looks so good, but the art looks so good that they kind of forget about a little bit of the game, especially depending on who's playing.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what I was talking about that way, I guess. Just trying to get that so I get real feedback as opposed to, oh, it looks pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think I've struggled with that too. And it, Playtesting, like when Jason and I went to Grand Con several months ago, and we just sat at a table for 2 days and demoed prototypes to just play as much as possible. And it was a struggle a lot of the time to figure out if they were judging the presentation or the gameplay. And the only way to determine that was to ask a lot of questions about the game, about their experience, and also just sheer volume of testing to try and get that exposure to as many people as possible and hopefully get some of them to focus on the gameplay, not on the art. Yeah, that was tough.
As for cute animals killing each other, that's essentially what Pokemon is, so it can be successful. They just knock each other out instead of killing each other.
Yes. Well, yeah, so I don't... And that's another thing. I don't know how far to go down that rabbit hole of do I make it cute but then kill them, or do I make it they're hurt, you know, like, or unconscious. I'm always a big fan of, like, Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, like, comic books and stuff. So, like, I just want blood everywhere, but I don't know. I think that will completely limit my audience a bit.
We have another Twitter comment here. This is from Paul Sang. He says he uses an X for art placement and then will show an image of how the art style will be in the future, and that's worked well for him. In his opinion, layout takes priority.
Yeah, sure, I think it's valid. I mean, yeah. the old wisdom of don't do the artwork for your game is that you become too attached to it, and you won't let things go that need to be let go. But I think that comes, you know, with experience, you learn to accept failure often, and more often than not, because we realize that, you know, most of the things that we work on don't really come to fruition. And so if you can, once you get over that hump, then spending time on the artwork, for me, really helps me stay involved with the project, because there is a whole lot of downtime in my design process where I'm working on an issue and I just kind of have to let it go for a while. So I can do a little bit of layout or art or whatever and come back to it. But then I have to realize it doesn't matter if I just spent 17 hours designing, you know, the art for three cards. If those cards suck, they just need to go away. And, you know, maybe someday I'll recycle the artwork, maybe I won't. But I, you know, you got to be willing to accept that failure.
Something Rob and I have done along those lines to try and avoid the time consumption, and kind of what Paul said is, you know, having like, oh, here's an image of what my art will kind of be like.
Right.
We've done that before where we'll get an artist we know to do a couple drawings for us, for kind of the art style. And I even kind of like doing that when I talk to publishers to be able to say, this is kind of the feeling I'm going for with this game. Now your vision may not align with that, and hey, their vision takes priority, right? So, but that kind of, I know that a game that Rob had that was really helpful with was Frankenstein's Legacy, which was a game about, it's a deck building game where you're trying to create a Frankenstein monster. And when Rob first pitched it to me and when we started talking about it, I didn't quite get the feeling for the type of game, the style kind of game it would be, until Rob had a couple pieces of artwork done. And as soon as I saw that, I understood how he wanted the game to feel when we played it. And that helped give better feedback. That helped get better feedback, I think, from people like at Grand Con who tried it and gave feedback. Just my opinion, but I know that that's worked for Rob and I in the past with some of our different prototypes.
Yeah, that can really help with just kind of to communicate the tone that you're trying to achieve with the game. At least, yeah, so.
Yeah.
Sure.
Does it make it more fun?
Well, in that case, no, it didn't. Yeah. No, Frankenstein's Legacy is a game that I'm very happy with and very pleased that I spent a lot of time working on, and I have accepted that it will never go anywhere, and that's okay. It's, you know, everything is a learning process, and every project you grow from, so that's cool.
Failure is always an option.
Absolutely.
Wonderful attitude.
Hey, it's 8:55, so around this time, every time we do this, we kind of like to wrap up and just, Jason Tagmeyer, since you're the guest this week, is there any awesome words of wisdom you would impart to other designers who are listening to this right now? And remember that once you say it, it's going to be out there forever, so make it really, really good.
find a relative, and no, I don't know. So my, I guess my words of wisdom would be to really explore all of your options and just do them. Basically, I decided that I was going to try not so much to design full-time because it's impossible, but just to really go to every convention that I could, every, you know, contest that I could enter, every opportunity with publishers to you know, get your game in front of them. If you're not doing that, then, you know, you're definitely below the guy next to you that's doing it. So I would suggest everything that you can do, just do it. You really need to kind of wear a whole bunch of different hats. If I've had opportunities to, you know, release games myself, and like, you know, like Chevy with the Game Crafter and everything like that, the more you're thrown out there, the better, you know, better network you're creating, and, you know, I don't know. That's exactly what I'm doing, and I've had a couple really lucky things happen, and it wouldn't happen if I wasn't throwing myself out there everywhere. So I think there's a lot of, you know, who you know in getting picked up in games and everything, but there's also a lot of luck. There's so many games out there right now and so many designers, but, you know, only so many can be published, so throw your chances out there to try to be that lucky one. That's my words of wisdom.
It's good advice. It's good advice.
Yeah. I mean, we don't talk about that enough, just getting yourself out there and just doing as much as you can to be in a spot where you can be lucky. That was like Sentinels of the Multiverse guys. They always talk about how they just were they put themselves in the right place at the right time, and they ended up with a hit, you know? And that's just... It won't happen all the time, but, like, it's sweet to see. Also, you should go to Unpub 4, because I think, Jason, you're going to be there, right?
I will be there.
Do you have a new promo?
I do,
like,
but
this
it's
one from last year?
It's a secret. ask Daryl about it. He'll tell you.
So you guys will both be there then, TC and Jason?
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. I'm going to be there as well, so good times.
That's where Maximum Throwdown got picked up by AEG last year, so it's highly suggested.
Cool. Wow, I didn't know it got nice. Picked up then. I thought it got picked up a little later.
That's well, sweet. It got played by AEG there.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, picked up later.
I will not be going on Pub 4 because I got tickets to see Monty Python in London.
You did? I thought you did it.
They opened more shows and we got tickets, so I'm going to Europe in July.
Wow.
Nice.
So lame.
Yeah. No unpub trip for me, sadly.
Excellent.
Cool. Well, if nobody has anything else, I just want to thank you guys for listening or watching, whatever. I'm used to saying listening. You can find this on our YouTube channel for Building the Game Podcast. Also, you can go to the BTG Co-op. That's btgco-op.com. And on Tuesday, this gets posted with a link. And, we're here every other week doing this. I just want to thank everybody for coming, especially Jason for being a guest tonight.
Thank you, guys.
Having all the time with us.
If everybody can real quick just shout out their websites, where can we find you? Jason, let's start with you.
Me, Jason?
Yeah.
it's buttonshy.com is kind of like my hub. It's button as in art and shy as in hiding from people.
Nice. Chevy.
Chevy.com, like always. I'm there every day, I think.
All right. TC?
I was trying to update this really fast. But yeah, I am Puppy Shogun. Ding. On Twitter. That's usually the best way to get to me. And you can check out my Tumblr blog. And yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Cool. All right. And Jason and I at Slinger, Jason Slingerland and I at buildingthegamepodcast.com.
Awesome.
Cool. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, guys. Good night.
Thanks. Yeah.